Support for the Splendid Table podcast provided by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. Online at muirglen.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. In this week's podcast, you're going to find something new. From now on, we're bringing you the entire hour of the Splendid Table in podcast form. Here it comes. Hope you enjoy. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. When James Osland was 19, he spent a summer in Indonesia with a classmate's family. He returned home, but his heart and his appetite stayed behind. Now, after 23 years of exploring the region, James has written Cradle of Flavor, home cooking from the Spice Islands of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. Wine maven Josh Wesson picks the best of the boxes and cans. Baking expert Dory Greenspan has the info that could save your holidays, all the unexpected goodies that you can freeze ahead. The author of Seduced by Bacon brings us the strips worth tracking down. And it's the best of street cart dining in New York City. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, there have been rumors that you two have been in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, I have also heard that this is a place to find great fried chicken. And on my trips there, I have never had the time to do it. So I want to know, did you search? Did you discover?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Your assignment, should you choose to take it.
No, if you're in the mood for good fried chicken, Charlotte is like fried chicken central. There are so many good places in the city and, you know, a half hour's drive from the city where you can get fabulous fried chicken.
Do you want to say our best, our favorite?
Well, one of our favorites, if you want to take a little drive out into the country, is in Statesville. It's called Keaton's Fried Chicken, where it's deep fried and then quickly dipped in like hot, and I mean peppery hot barbecue
but
sauce.
But back in Charlotte,
let's go back to Charlotte. Okay,
is a place called Price's Chicken Coop, which for the longest time I thought was Chicken Co-op, but it isn't. neither is it really a coop. I mean, you know, it's a restaurant.
Well, it's not a restaurant; it's a takeout restaurant. But believe me, anytime you go there, there will be long lines of people waiting to take out this chicken because it is no secret in Charlotte that this is one of the handful of great places to get fried chicken.
And with the chicken, you have to get what really, without a doubt, the best sweet tea that I've ever had in the South, you know, sweetened iced tea. But the chicken, which is deep fried, not pan fried, uh-huh, which usually is my second choice. But I don't know what they do at Price's. It is just an absolute brittly tender crust. And the chicken itself is, oh, my God. I mean, words fail me. Michael, jump in and help me.
Well, I mean, it's the kind of chicken that drips all over you, and you love the fact that it drips all over you, and it's a mess to eat, and you're pulling strips of crust off the bird and then strips of meat, which are just like dripping moisture. But one of the things that struck me when we ate the chicken there is that not only are the chicken parts that we all know and love so good, the dark meat, even the white meat is really juicy, but mm-hmm, parts of the chicken that I almost never order were really good, too. We got livers and gizzards. And frankly, I don't even know what a gizzard is, but man, are they good.
Oh, they can be fabulous, but nobody makes this stuff anymore.
Well, Price's does. Chicken livers and gizzards are right on the menu, along with quarter chickens, half chickens, and whole chickens, as well as wings, of course.
What does the place actually look like? I mean, is it just you go up to a window and you order and that's it?
Well, it's a little takeout place, kind of on the wrong side. It's right near the railroad tracks. I don't want to say the wrong side of the tracks, but it's near the tracks. There's a line of people outside. You go up to the counter, you place your order, you get it pretty quickly because they've always got it going. Mm-hmm. And you know, you get it in a little cardboard box, which everyone in town knows. And the side dishes with the chicken, in addition to that iced tea that Jane mentioned, which is as good as it gets. The favorite side dish among most of Price's fans is tater tots, which somehow look just great in that box along with the chicken.
I don't know. Once you're into frying, you go all the
way,
right?
I didn't bother with the tater tots or the coleslaw or the spongy
white. The coleslaw is very good.
Yeah, I don't know. I just threw everything out of the box except for the chicken. And when I looked at myself in the rearview mirror of our car, I mean, I literally had chicken in my hair, on my chest, on my shoulders. It was quite the sight.
I'm picturing you two sitting on the curb just tearing into these boxes, you know, right outside the building. You can't wait any longer.
That's not
far
from
the
truth.
We were like rabid dogs.
You guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Hello, cat. I just got back, and I'm looking for that place they call the Chicken Shack. They say it's fine as wine, and it's really on a ball. No windows, no doors, it's just a hole in the wall. Did you say it was located down by the creek, where you can get a whole gob of good things to eat? All good parts of the chicken once more is a cinch. You can even get the last part that went over the fence.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know where. SplendidTable.org. Now, speaking of takeout chicken, this plea came in from a listener. She wanted to know why her barbecue wings never taste like the takeout ones. Evidently, they're not tender and crisp enough. And she explained that she uses the oven or the grill with temps around 425 degrees for 45 minutes. Well, I've got the wings skinny. The best way to handle wings is to first marinate, and marinate some more. Then do slow and low. Slow cooking, low heat. So you want to set your oven at about 325 or grill over low fire and spread your wings out because the less they touch, the crisper they're going to be. You cook them for about 90 minutes to 2 hours and occasionally pierce them with a knife. That's to drain off the fat. And keep basting with the marinade. And if you want them crisper, okay, in the last few minutes of cooking, just rack up the heat. Now, the only way you can ruin wings is if you cook them too high for too short a time or if you burn them. And by the way, they reheat like magic. So I have got a recipe on the website that you can use as a test run. It's called Apricot Glazed Tabasco Wings. Find it at SplendidTable.org. Some people get it all. Like wine expert Josh Wesson. He was winning awards as a sommelier when he had barely reached the legal drinking age. He co-authored a now cult book, Red Wine with Fish. And then Josh walked away from those bottles priced in three figures. He dedicated himself to tracking down great sipping from modest money. And that was for his next project, his bestsellers wine shops. Hey, Josh, good to have you back.
Always good to be back.
All right, Josh, I've got one of those my eyebrow is raised questions. Wine in a box, wine in a can, wine in a juice pack? I mean, are we looking here at sort of plunk?
Oh, no. I mean, it was plunk maybe 10 years ago because the technology for sticking wine in boxes and wine in little cans and wine in juice packs has existed for a while. But nobody put any good wine in until recently. But I'd say in the last 3 years, there's been an explosion of deliciousness in the form of these alternative packages. And boxes rock. I am so enamored of them, I can't even tell you. I love boxed wines.
Now, why? Why?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, they don't break on impact.
That's a good point, yeah.
They stack neatly under the bed or in the fridge, you know, where space is the final frontier.
Right.
They're cheaper to make than glass bottles. So one could say theoretically that you're getting a better value because you're not paying for the packaging as much as you do for a glass bottle. They're way more portable than bottles and jugs. I mean, you go out to a picnic, you don't want to be lugging pounds and pounds of fragile glass around. Much better to just throw a couple of boxes in a cooler and take it with you. And, you know, in a pinch, you can even rip the box in two. You take the plastic baggie that's inside these things, mm-hmm. and you squeeze it like a water balloon the next time you're ambushed in a wine fight. You know, it's perfect.
I,
You know, these are the things that you think to prepare for that never dawn on me. There's something else. Now you're reminding me. Isn't it true also because it's in those plastic bags, not a lot of air can get to the wine,
which, in some cases,
is desirable?
You know, if I told you that there was a specially designed container that would keep wine fresh for over a month, you could just tap it at will, and it would taste as delicious in the last glass as it would the first, and it's going to cost you less. And, I mean, how can you resist this? They keep wine, boxes, bags, cylinders, keep wine deliciously fresh for over a month, whereas a bottle, once the cork's been pulled, maybe you'll get a couple of days out of it. And if you're drinking red wine for the health benefits, you're drinking it because you want to get this substance called resveratrol. It unclogs your arteries. It's like a roto-rooter for your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And this stuff evaporates and oxidizes like a tipsy genie out of a bottle, you know, in an hour or two. So if you want to maintain the health benefits, getting wine in a box is better for you than in a bottle, because you'll continue to have that resveratrol in perfect condition. So these boxes are safer, they're lighter, they're cheaper, they're tastier, they're healthier, and you don't need an opposable digit to get a glass.
Well, okay.
Case closed.
With this health information that you have given us, people are now champing at the bit. Name some names for us.
Well, I just went to a box tasting, and I should say I'm going to throw in cylinders and Tetra Paks, too.
Okay, yeah, because we want to talk about those, too.
You know, Black Box Chardonnay from California, insanely good, about $25 for four bottles worth. These come in 3-liter boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Banrock Station from Australia, Shiraz, delicious picnic wine, about $15-16 for four bottles in a box.
That's pretty cheap.
Crazy. Delicato makes an insanely good Shiraz from California for about $12 or $13. I mean, you could lip this, you know, all day long like orange knee-highs. And my absolute favorite one of the tappable boxes is not a box at all. It's a cylinder. And it's made by Dominique Lafon from Comte Lafon, very famous French producer of white Burgundy. And he teamed up with Daniel Jonas and Daniel Ballou here in New York. Ballou's a restaurateur chef, of course. Daniel Jonas is a big wine guy. And they make a Macon Village, which they call Detour. And it comes in this little cylinder. It's so cute. It's fabulous. Four bottles worth of Macon made by this famous guy for $40. Ah. I mean, I've tapped this and given it to my wine friends. It blows their minds every time. And they love it. You don't need a corkscrew. Half the households in the United States don't have corkscrews. This solves the problem. It's unbelievable.
What about the juice packs?
I love juice packs because they're so goofy. You know, if you had to buy pizza without buying it by the slice, nobody would ever buy pizza. I don't know why people look down on the idea of breaking a regular bottle into sections to sell off. Bandit, which is made by a company called Three Thieves. Joel Gott is the winemaker. Very cool, because they steal batches of wine from different places that people have left over. And then they put it in these cute little 250-milliliter Tetra Paks, which look like exactly like juice packs, because they are juice packs. They make Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Grigio. They sell for about $10 for a 4-pack of this stuff, so $2.50 a little box.
That's four really generous glasses.
Yeah, generous, like a glass and a half of each.
Yeah.
And you sneak these in your little picnic basket and take it to the ballpark, and you'll enjoy baseball, you know, which is very hard to enjoy without a little bit of wine.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
I apologize to the St. Louis Cardinals for Josh. Josh Wesson is co-founder of Bestsellers Wine Shops, and you can get Josh's box and can wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. While you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletters. Now, we've got two of them. The Classic Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Now, every week, you get a new recipe, and as usual, both e-newsletters are free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the Asian cuisines we never knew, the secrets of the pastry chef, and seduction by bacon. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Well, you would think with so many Asian flavors showing up in our food that we would have tasted just about all of the cuisines, right? Not so. There is a big gap, a cluster of countries that arc down from Thailand and Cambodia. Now, think about how much we know of Java or Sumatra or Malaysia. Next to nothing. Except for Savour magazine's executive editor, James Osland. Long before he became a food writer, James was seduced by this part of the Pacific. After 23 years of trekking and living with families there, he's written Cradle of Flavor, Home Cooking from the Spice Islands of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. James, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm thinking about the setup here. You were 19 years old. You were a student in San Francisco, and a classmate invites you to spend the summer at her home. Did you have any idea where you were going?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, I guess I was kind of really a sort of typical American guy, kind of raised on Gilligan's Island and pot roast. And, and I got this completely serendipitous invitation to this part of the world that really, you know, sure, I'd probably read the name a few times in the Encyclopedia Britannica that we had at home. But other than that, I really kind of knew nothing.
So just take us through this. You went to Jakarta, right?
That's right. That's right. That's where Tanya's family was based for the most part, yes.
And this is Java.
This is in Java. Jakarta is Indonesia's largest city. It's Indonesia's New York City. But though it's in Java, it's kind of very different from the rest of Indonesia, almost like New York City is very different from the rest of America, except it's almost like Indonesia concentrated. You'll find everybody from Indonesia living there in the city.
So what was that first trip like for you?
Oh, truly, truly amazing. I mean, it really did kind of just, it just kind of turned me upside down and all around. It was almost like when I got there, I mean, it really was kind of like a Wizard of Oz kind of experience. And certainly the foods that I ate, like in the first couple of weeks and then over time, over the next few months, as I say, you know, I'd kind of known pretty much just basic American food, pot roast, fried chicken, our staples here. Wonderful, wonderful foods, to be sure. But I got over there, and everything was so vivid, so potent, so lush, so amazing, but at the same time, kind of ultimately familiar. Maybe that's because there are a lot of the same spices that we're familiar with from our foods over here, including cloves, nutmeg, cassia, familiar flavors, but then the unfamiliar flavors too, such as at that time, for me anyway, lemongrass, galangal, even ginger was actually an unfamiliar flavor to me.
What was it like to sit down? You were staying with a family, your friend's family, and they came together at the table. What was it like those first meals? I mean, what were you tasting?
It was daunting at first. And another funny thing is, over there, people eat with their hands, with their right hands, in fact. And at first, this just seemed just so utterly wrong, so forbidden. This is exactly what we're taught not to do here. But over there, people were doing it with such grace, such elegance, such knowingness that, you know, after the third or fourth or fifth time of watching this, I decided, okay, very, very cautiously, I'm going to plunge in and do this and hope that nobody's watching. And over time, over, you know, actually a very brief time, it became a very comfortable, very sensuous, beautiful way of eating. And I tend to not do it here when I'm at home. But as soon as I'm back over there, I immediately plunge back into that, literally plunge back into that.
You say in the book that for the longest time you ate and the food was interesting, but that there was a moment when the food suddenly, you suddenly had a revelation about the food. And how did that come about?
I think what had happened to me was I'd gotten quite ill on that first trip that I'd made over there. and spent about a month or so recuperating. And at one point, my friend Tanya and her family, they were gone. And so I was there alone in the house with the cooks who work in the house. They were basically my companions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ventured into the kitchen, and it was this lovely half-indoor, half-outdoor space. And it was just so comfy and cozy and earthy, and there were always people hanging out there and telling jokes and cutting vegetables and pounding ingredients in mortars and pestles that were situated down on the ground. And one afternoon I ventured down there, and I decided to stay, and I pretty much ended up staying for the next couple of months. And I made great, great friends with the cooks who worked in the house. And slowly they would teach me what they were making, and through this process, it just became like an amazing conduit into understanding this place that, up until that moment, as wonderful as it was, had kind of felt foreign, had kind of felt different, other. But all of a sudden, when I was spending this really fabulous time in the kitchen, it started to make sense. I started to really own it and have fun, too.
You were 19 years old at that time.
I was 19 years old, yep.
For you, what would be the dish that is most significant or most symbolic of this whole world that you were part of?
I think there's a dish that immediately comes to mind that we're vaguely familiar with here in the West called rendang, R-E-N-D-A-N-G. And the dish originated in West Sumatra, which is actually a province of Indonesia on the island of Sumatra.
Mm-hmm.
And the dish actually is more of a cooking method than a dish per se, because all sorts of main ingredients can be used to make it. But the one we're most familiar with here is made of beef. It starts out with a really extraordinary flavoring paste. What over there is called a bumbu bumbu and literally translates as seasoning or flavor. And this flavoring paste consists of usually fresh red chilies, shallots, garlic, ginger, lemongrass,
oh boy,
galangal, cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon. This flavoring paste is rubbed over the beef. And then a lot of really rich, wonderful coconut milk is added to a pot. Over there, the dish is usually cooked in a wok. And it's allowed to very, very slowly bubble, like bloop, 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 no faster than that,
right,
for a good few hours, until all of the liquids in the dish, or most of them anyway, have evaporated or gone into the beef, the main ingredient. And then what's left in the pan is this really extraordinarily luscious, by then braised flavoring paste, and the fats from the beef and from the coconut milk. And then the beef is allowed to gently saute in this ultra flavorful
oil. So it gets crisp
oil.
And crunchy.
Oh,
and
absolutely. It's the loveliest thing. And it really is a kind of signature dish of the region. For me, it really does connote the place. It really feels like the place. It really tastes like that place that I love so much.
James, thank you. I'm so ready to eat that. Thank
me
you.
Me too. Thank you.
James Oseland is executive editor of Savour magazine and author of Cradle of Flavor, Home Cooking from the Spice Islands of Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore. And if you think I was going to let James get away without leaving the recipe for beef rendang, you're nuts. You can get it on the website. Find it at splendidtable.org. Food Authority Dori Greenspan is one of those consummate pros. You've heard her on the show critiquing kitchen equipment, which she does too for Bon Appetit magazine. Dori's also co-authored books on baking with Julia Child and French pastry deity Pierre Hermé. But my favorite book of Dori's is her latest masterwork, and I am not using that word loosely, Baking from My Home to Yours. Hey, Dori, welcome.
Glad to be back with you.
Yeah, Dori, you've spent all this time in professional pastry kitchens. You know, you've worked with the greats. What are the things that really stand out for you about how they work?
You know, I'm laughing because when I first went into a kitchen, what really surprised me was how they work just the way we work at home. But they have more equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And what they use that I think we home bakers often forget to use as a tool is their freezers. So much of what is done in a professional kitchen is done ahead. And there are so many things about that we can learn at home and use at home that would just make baking life so much easier.
For instance?
Well, for instance, you should know what you can freeze. And actually, with baking, you can freeze most everything. Things that are based on butter really, really freeze well. So this can give you a jump on weekend baking or holiday baking. Think about pound cakes or tight-grained loaf cakes or sturdy bundt cakes and brownies and chunky cookies. All of these things can be made ahead and frozen. Even cakes that are filled and frosted with, swirls of buttercream
mm-hmm.
can be frozen ahead. And, my favorite cookie is the World Peace Cookie, and it's a slice-and-bake cookie, and I keep rolls of that dough in the freezer. So you should really think about what you can freeze. Think about what you can't freeze. I mean, it's kind of sad, but you can't freeze pumpkin pie, and you can't freeze meringues, and you can't freeze puddings. But you can freeze, and I love this, you can freeze pie and tart dough. You can have it all rolled out in the pan, and you can pop it into the freezer and have it ready to go.
Do you have to defrost it?
No. Pie doughs that are in the pan, ready to go, tart mm-hmm. doughs can go straight into the oven. And in fact, what I love to do is if I've made a fruit pie, like an apple pie, double-crusted apple pie,
mm-hmm.
I freeze the pie unbaked. It's actually better to freeze it unbaked than baked. And then it goes directly from the freezer into the oven, and you just have to give it a little more time so that the crust browns and the fruit inside bubbles. So you can have all of your pies just ready to go. And this is really what the pros do. If you're going to freeze something, though, it's really important that you cool first and freeze second. So you have to make sure that everything cools down to room temperature if you're going to be freezing something that's been baked. And it's interesting. I've always thought that cooling should be considered part of baking, that it's really the process in which whatever you've baked settles and its texture comes into its own. And I think baked things aren't finished until they're cooled. So you need to cool and then you can freeze. If you've got a great birthday cake, if you've got something, a layer cake that's filled and frosted with buttercream or frosting, then what you should do is pop it into the freezer, get it cold, take it out, and then wrap it. So that way the frosting will stay.
So you don't have the mushy and the smushy.
The mushy and the smushy. And of course, there's nothing better, I think, than opening your freezer and seeing a party cake that needs nothing. But it's all there, ready to go. You just have to defrost it. So get it solid, then wrap it up. And no matter what you're freezing, wrap it airtight, because oxygen is really what causes frozen goods to deteriorate. So wrap it really well and then defrost it slowly. So you want to freeze it quickly and defrost it slowly. If you can, the best thing to do with things that you've frozen is to keep them in their wrappers and move them from the freezer to the refrigerator overnight. And then if they need to come to room temperature, bring them out. So that way you're really maintaining the best qualities of the cake or the cookie or whatever it is that you've frozen. And I have one other rule about freezing.
Yeah?
It's really important.
Yeah?
Don't be smug. There's nothing like
you mean, don't come to the table with that attitude of nanny, nanny, no, no.
Yeah, just because I've been a genius, just because I look like a magician, just because I've been able to bring out the most gorgeous dessert you've ever seen,
yes,
without having any chocolate under my fingernails, just be humble about it.
Dory, thank you.
It's been fun to be with you.
Tori Greenspan is author of Baking from My Home to Yours. Now, to do a fancy cake ahead, try Dory's recipe for cocoa buttermilk birthday cake. And don't save it just for birthdays. By the way, it has chocolate malt buttercream. So good. Find the recipe, splendidtable.org. I got a question for you. Is there anything more enticing than the smell of cooking bacon? Well,
maybe just one thing, that first bite. Food writer Joanna Pruis has given over an entire book to the subject. She's author of Seduced by Bacon. Welcome, Joanna.
Hey, Lynn. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm curious about something because we're seeing a lot of good bacon in the markets. And the other thing, now on restaurant menus, they identify the bacon. It's like now bacon has become designer food.
Well, I think that what happened is people really want, number one, a lot more flavor in their foods. And they want comfort and they want style. So if you go back to the first one, flavor, two slices adds immeasurably, even to the most blasé piece of chicken or piece of fish. Mm-hmm. And then that flavor and that memory, it lingers with you like a great affair.
I like the comparison. Do you think, though, I'm thinking about the tremendous growth that we have seen in artisan-produced foods. And is this playing into this, that we're seeing more of these, you know, small-scale bacon producers?
Sure, there's a lot of bacon out there. If you look at any supermarket, there is a huge expansion in supermarkets, in any store. But there's also these wonderful regional bacons. There are bacons that are cured by chefs, that are cured by people who are just working to make the best bacon. It starts from where they grow, how the animals are fed, and these bacons are coming to market.
Joanna, what's the difference between dry-cured bacon and wet-cured bacon?
When it is wet cured, it is soaked in a brine, and that can vary from 2 to 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
In contemporary bacon making, they sometimes just inject the liquid into
That's the commercial, what you see in the market.
That
all the time,
is exactly kind of right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is rubbed, and then it is hung to dry. And then it is or is not smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Dry curing is that you simply rub the meat with a salt mixture, and then it is air dried. And in Apicius's time, and the Chinese started this in the 2nd century before the Christian era, the pork was salted for 17 days, then it was air-dried for 2 days, and finally it was smoked for 2 more days. That's the dry curing method. That's the oldest of the two methods. And so there's a difference. The dry cure will have a far more intense flavor. As you can imagine, there has never been any moisture in it.
Yeah, yeah. So you wouldn't see water mentioned on the label with a dry-cured bacon?
No,
okay.
You would not. And the thing is that water, especially if it's artificially injected, and you put it into a pan, Lynn, what happens is it just flows out, and you get a lot of shrink.
So, Joanna, can you name some names?
Well, to start, there are three fabulous N-words. There is Nodine's from Torrington, Connecticut, Newski's from Wisconsin, and Nyman Ranch, which is headquartered in California. But, you know, there are so many wonderful bacons out there. I think if you just go into any community that does farming, get out there and try it. You'll be so rewarded.
Hey, Joanna, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Food writer Joanna Pruis is author of Seduced by Bacon. Now, she left us with one of those you won't believe how good this is recipes. It's just like those sweet, salty caramels. You can find the recipe for pecan, brown sugar, bacon ice cream on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay. Time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest must-have gadget for lobster lovers? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest must-have gadget for lobster lovers? Well, all you Time magazine readers know the answer. If you're timid about cooking lobster, you have to have the invention of a British barrister. It was reported in Time under the category of Best Inventions of 2006. And by the way, the Geek Squad voted it the best gadget of this year. Okay, you ready? You want a crustastun. It uses electric shocks to stun and then dispatch lobsters to the great beyond in seconds. Now, supposedly a kinder and gentler passing, but that statement is much debated by the scientific types. Crustastun will fit in your appliance garage. It looks like a deep fryer. It takes up only 18 square inches of counter space, and it's going to be on the market in December, which is a good thing because you're going to need to put your pennies aside. Crustastun will sell for $4,700. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, we have Bob calling from Detroit. Hey, Bob, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about lemongrass.
Oh, I love lemongrass.
And I was at a nursery a couple of months ago, and they had some lemongrass plants, which I went and planted, and they're growing very nicely. And a couple of weeks ago, I took some lemongrass, and I cut it up and put it in a soup that I usually make.
Uh-huh.
And it was awful.
What was the soup? What was the soup?
Well, actually, I make sort of a version of a Thai soup with chicken stock and chicken and ginger.
It sounds like it should have been delicious.
And it should have been, but the lemongrass was hard. It was really tough.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And is there something that you do to lemongrass?
Well, this is the thing. As you know, it's these long, they almost look like reeds.
Yes.
And they have a very tough outer sort of long reed leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the part that barely is tender is right near the ground, you know, right near the bottom. It's the bottom, essentially, and it's a couple of inches. Now, the rest of it has great flavor, and you can pound it and you can put it in a food processor and that kind of thing, but it's very fibrous.
Yes.
But lemongrass is rarely kind of, I don't know, I want to say it's not eaten, but that base, as you go into the core of that bottom of the stalk, it will be something that you can pound or you can puree, and you'll get great flavor out of it. You know,
so I could use it in big chunks and just throw it into the broth.
Yeah, and just bruise it so you get even more flavor. And you know what's wonderful to do with that? You can make sorbets or you can make panna cotta, and panna cotta is just cream, warmed cream with gelatin, some sour cream, and flavoring, and sugar. And what you can do is, as you're warming the cream, you can have chopped up lemongrass in there.
Ooh.
And let it sit for a while, like you're making tea, and then strain it out.
And then
see. And you can and use a ton of it, so you get real flavor. The same thing, you can use that kind of thing in making ice cream.
Wow, that sounds wonderful.
Isn't that?
I never thought of that for you.
Yeah.
Well, super.
Hey, thank you.
I knew you'd have the answer.
I try. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Tansley up next from Farmington Hills, Michigan. Tansley, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you? It's wonderful to speak with you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I have a very important question. My mom is retiring after 30 years of teaching English. And I'm having a retirement party for her. And what we'd like to do, it's a literary theme, so I'm asking people to come in literary costumes. And I'd like to serve literary food. But
oh,
I haven't come up with
a great idea.
Thank you. But I haven't come up with anything brilliant in terms of a menu, and I was hoping you might be able to help.
Is there a particular period in literature or geographic location in period, for instance, the English Romantic poets or Southern writers of the 20th century? I mean, is there an area that she really is fascinated by or has taken great pleasure in?
Well, the one thing she did write her thesis on Faulkner. And so my one thought was to maybe do some kind of Southern.
Oh, yeah. You know, that makes it really easy, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really makes it easy. There's a couple of really great books out there. And, you know, the thing about Southern food right. is that it is localized. I mean, you have regional food, but
sure.
fried chicken.
Sure. Yep,
you know, serve cold or served hot, but fried chicken. You right. got to do fried chicken.
Okay.
Pimento cheese.
Oh, that's...
Have you ever had that?
I haven't.
It's an interesting thing because it sounds awful and it's utterly wonderful.
Oh, great.
It's literally something like a cheddar cheese or an American cheese that's diced and it's mixed with pimento
oh, wow.
and mayonnaise.
Oh, wow.
And it's we have a recipe on the website.
Oh, great.
Okay. And I'm trying to think now. Well, coleslaw.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet sour coleslaw.
Yep.
Coconut cake.
Oh,
and,
coconut cake.
And if you could do coconut. And by the way, I have some cookbooks for you to go to.
Oh, good.
Because these are classic recipes. But coconut cake, if you really want to go over the top, done with fresh coconut. I mean, it doesn't have to be.
Right.
You know, the greens are great. You know, the greens cooked in pot liquor, you know, and with
right.
ham. Somebody could do homemade biscuits.
Oh, that's a great one.
With thin slivers of country ham or of just a good ham.
Right.
The cookbooks I'm thinking of for the Low Country, which would be South Carolina, North Carolina,
right.
Georgia, you want to look at John Martin Taylor.
Okay.
His Hoppin' John, he did, I think, something called the Low Country Cookbook.
Oh, great.
Natalie Dupre.
Okay.
D-U-P-R-E is another source. She's done a lot on the South.
Right.
Bill Neal. Now, his books, he published back in the 70s and 80s, and he passed away, but he has got wonderful recipes, especially for desserts and
okay.
cornbread and things like that.
Oh, good. Yep.
I'm just trying to think now. There's so many good Southern cookbooks. Oh, Edna Lewis.
Okay.
Edna Lewis, and there was a book that she did with Scott Peacock
okay.
in partnership. She passed away last year, but oh. anything with her name on it, you're going to love.
Oh, great.
Okay, and she does lots of interesting things with vegetables.
Oh, super.
Okay. Oh, what a lovely idea, though,
wonderful.
For a party for her.
I hope so. We're hoping it's going to be great.
Oh, hey, tell her congratulations from us.
I will. Thanks so much for your help.
You are welcome. You
have
take
a great
care.
Day.
You
take
too.
Care.
Bye-bye. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Ara on the line from St. Louis. Ara, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Hey, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm originally from Argentina, and
yeah.
at the pizza shops there, they have something that's very delicious called faina. It's sort of like a focaccia bread, and it's just very simple but very good. And whenever I've looked up recipes in different books, or the internet, I follow the instructions, use the right ingredients, but it never turns out quite the same.
Now,
so I'm wondering if you knew.
Well, you know what I'm remembering, and this goes back about 10, 15 years ago. My best friend, Cara Da Silva, who's a New Yorker, was the ethnic foods editor. She covered all the ethnic neighborhoods for New York Newsday newspaper. And I remember we were exploring a new neighborhood in Queens, which had a huge number of people from Argentina. And we went into this incredible pizzeria, and we were served a pizza-like bread that had onions and cheese on it.
Uh-huh.
And then on top of that was a thin, what I know from Italy as being a farinata, and what is called in southern France a socca. It was like a chickpea pancake.
And that's what it is.
Yeah, and it was, but it was on top. It was like made separately and on top of the pizza that was just cheese and onions. And the other way it came, the pizza was also just onions. And I think the name of the chickpea thing was faina or fana. You come from the country. You know far more than I
right,
do.
Right. It's yeah, faina.
But the combination was killer. And that chickpea cake can be unbelievably good. Now, when you say faina, it is the chickpea then, right?
Yes, it is.
It
and
is.
The recipes that I have consist of exactly what you said with those ingredients. But when I make it just in a regular oven, it just turns into a hard crust, like a focaccia, but it's not quite the same
thing. In Argentina, how thick is it?
It's It's about 1 inch thick, maybe.
See, that's much thicker than in Italy, because the secret in Italy is you've got a lot of olive oil in this very shallow, wide, circular pan, and it's done in an oven, but it can also be done on top of a big griddle, you know what I'm saying, where you have the pan sitting over a lot of heat.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what I'm wondering is maybe you need more water and oil in the recipe.
Maybe.
Is it ever served there on top of a pizza?
It is, and sometimes it puts in slices of Parmesan because it's the whole saltiness thing about it. It's so, well, maybe I'll just have to go there and investigate further.
I think you may want to go back home. And what you might want to do is take me with you. And
yes,
I'll
exactly.
just be, you know, I'll travel in your luggage. I'll be the fly on the wall, and I'll just follow you, and I'll make notes, okay? But, you know, one other thing you might want to look at, I realize this wouldn't be the Argentinian method, but take a look at recipes for soca, S-O-C-C-A.
Okay, I'll look that up.
You look that up. The other thing is farinata, F-A-R-I-N-A-T-A. That's a name, by the way, for both this chickpea cake and a soup, but you'll find the chickpea part of it. But what you're making, it sounds like it needs more moisture in it, and maybe it needs higher heat.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
Okay, if you're going back to Argentina, call me.
Okay. Okay, so.
Right, you take care. Bye. This goes back to that whole thing about the huge Italian population that immigrated to Argentina. I remember we interviewed someone about traveling down there, and 60% of the population, if I remember correctly, is essentially of Italian descent. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Well, you know, there is a way to eat in New York that I don't think any other town can match. In fact, in one case, people actually drive in from New Jersey to wait in line, and it's not for a restaurant. It's for a $5 plate of halal chicken from a street vendor's cart. Now, this cart, by the way, happened to be the winner of last year's Vendy Award. Well, Seth Kugel, who writes the Weekend in New York column for the New York Times, has the story. Seth, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So whose cart was this, and where do we find it?
Well, this is at the corner of 53rd Street and Avenue of the Americas. And actually, if you forget that, you can actually just search for them on the web. They actually have a website as well.
The cart has a website? I love
this. Yeah,
the
cart has a website. Well, actually, I just realized you do have to remember the address to get to the website, because it's 53rdand6th.com. But it's really the most extraordinary place, because any time, really, from early in the evening until really 4:30 in the morning, the line stretches down the block, and if you didn't know what was happening there, you would just wonder what would make people wait for 40 minutes at 3 in the morning. And in fact, when I was there, I talked to some people who were staying in the Hilton Hotel, which is across the street, and they said they'd been watching this for the whole week, and it was their last night in New York, and they just had to go stand in the line to figure out what was going on.
Little did they know they were actually going to get some great food. What's on the plate?
It is very simple, actually. It's a chicken plate with rice, and there's actually some very sort of sad-looking lettuce in there as well. But everyone talks about this white sauce, and, you know, it's a hard taste to describe. Nobody could really tell me what they really liked about it when I was talking to people out there, but it is delicious. I did try it, and they're crazy for it.
Well, now, you say you can spend a whole weekend eating from the carts. Can you give us some examples?
Well, I spend many years eating from the carts. Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I like the crepes that they sell in Soho. A guy named Zakria Naimi sells crepes there. There's just a great taco truck, which is pretty new, actually, at 14th Street and 8th Avenue. It used to be, to get Mexican tacos, you'd have to go all the way up to 96th Street, where there's another great taco truck. But, you know, these are Mexican folks just making the tacos like they would in Mexico and selling them, for $2 each.
Uh-huh.
And they're open really all night, and the clientele is an absolute mix of Mexican laborers and people who just stumbled out of bars.
Yeah, I wonder about something. When you have a cart, are you assigned a location? Are you an entrepreneur? I mean, in the sense you just set up housekeeping wherever you feel the business is going
to
be?
No, you do have to have a license for a specific location. And, of course, not everybody does. And there are many, many problems with unlicensed vendors and the city. And there's actually a big movement for vendors' rights, which is actually how the Vendy Awards came about.
So what are the Vendy Awards? Can you explain those?
Sure. These are awards. They just had their second annual installment, and they're set up by an organization called the Street Vendors Project. I think I've got that right. And basically, they take nominees and pick the top ones and have them all come into Manhattan with their carts and have a cook-off, basically. The public is invited. You can buy tickets to it, and then the judges figure out who's the best. And I would like to congratulate them this year for really expanding beyond Manhattan. The winner this year was from Queens, Samuel's Halal Cart. And the other top contenders was one of my favorites, the Arepa Lady, who sells Colombian corn cakes from Queens, which, in case you didn't guess, is where I live.
You know, you've brought up a good point, though. So many people go to the New York City to visit, and they don't realize that there are the boroughs. There are the five boroughs of New York, and that there is fabulous food to be had, especially because there are so many ethnic communities in those areas.
Well, absolutely. And if people do have to go to one place, I can't recommend Jackson Heights more highly. It is literally a 15-minute subway ride from Grand Central Station, and all you have to do is walk out of the 7 train at either 74th Street or 82nd Street and just walk around, and you'll just bump into it all. Mostly Latin American, some South Asian. There's a big South Asian community with a lot of great restaurants there, but many, many of the street vendors are South American. It's great food, great eating.
Hey, Seth, thank you.
Thank you.
Seth Kugel is co-author of Nueva York, The Complete Guide to Latino Life in the Five Boroughs. And he also writes the Weekend in New York column for the New York Times. His article on street vendors and the Vendy Awards appeared in the paper's October 8th edition. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Jeff Arter. He said, "We live in an age when pizza gets to your home before the police." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Additional support comes from A.G. Edwards & Sons, caring for nest eggs for more than 118 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. A.G. Edwards, fully invested in their clients. Now, everything you heard here today, plus solutions for life's little problems and so much more, can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters. Weeknight Kitchens, our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle will get you baking over the weekend. You can also download our weekly podcast. Sign up for everything at splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by the Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection, gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Jonath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Thanks for tuning in. Join us next week and have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.